the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. Let's kind of take a review of what we're facing here. In Switzerland, we have plants being accorded rights. In Great Britain, in Canada, and in the United States, and in some European nations, there are organized movements trying to seek rights for primates, representational rights to have an attorney, rights that have never been given to animals before but have always been reserved for human beings before. Then we have all the controversy over human embryonic stem cell research, over euthanasia, you name it, that really get to the heart of the question of human dignity and the sanctity of human life. And the big question, we've got to face this question: why are human beings different? What is special about human beings that would justify a clear, moral, legal, conceptual distinction between humans and the animal kingdom? Why should human beings have any more rights than a chimpanzee, a dog, a cheetah, or an amoeba for that matter? There's a fascinating front page article in The New Scientist, one of the English-speaking world's most influential science journals. Here's what it says on the front. Special report: humans are obviously unique, but it's surprisingly hard to say why. We're going to take a look at some of the scientific arguments that are being made here, and we're going to see why these arguments are all falling short of anything that would actually justify a clear distinction between human beings and animals. We're going to talk about why that is absolutely important, and one of the things we're going to have to face very squarely is that only the biblical worldview provides an adequate justification for this distinction. And let me just offer you this prediction at the onset: once you forfeit the biblical worldview, you really don't have much to argue for when it comes to a distinction, something special, that makes human beings different than the rest of the created order. We'll be talking about that when we come back. I want to know what you're thinking about it. Give me a call at 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We try to talk about the most important issues out there as we frame the question of how Christians should start to think about the issues that confront us, but I can't really imagine an issue more important than this, because it's the big question of human dignity. All the other issues, whether you're talking about animal rights, plant rights, infanticide, abortion, anything else, it all comes back to this central question. To join the conversation, call me at 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. You go to any major college university campus, you go to any major community, and one of the biggest buildings you're likely to find is the library, for good reason. Very naturally, we associate libraries with learning. We associate books with scholarship. We associate massive learning with massive libraries. As a matter of fact, you can trace the development of the library as well as tracing the development of higher education, and you can't explain the modern university without the modern research library. Christians have a real stake in this because of the Christian culture of the book. You'll remember that one of the Apostle Paul's last exhortations to Timothy was, bring the books and the parchments. Christianity has been associated with the book from the very beginning. We are a religion, a faith of the book, having to do with the Bible. Our authority is an inscripturated revelation that it is in the form of a book. And where you find Christian learning, you find libraries. But there's something big going on, and that has to do with the digital revolution. And there are those out there who are suggesting that the age of the book is over, that there is no enduring purpose for a modern research library. Let me tell you just how it looks on the ground. I can tell you this as a college and seminary president. Students do not live in the library the way students did before. When I was a doctoral student, I was in the library every night until they kicked me out. The library was where you had to go if you wanted to get the information. It's where you camped out in order to read and in order to study. It's where you did information searches. I know there are people out there who are under the age of 30 who think this is nuts. But there once was a day when you had to go into a building and open all these little drawers of index cards and use your fingers to thumb through those cards until you found the book, and then you had to actually walk to a shelf and see if the book was there, and if it wasn't there, it wasn't there. You had to wait until it was there. There were no online editions. If your library did not have the journal from which you needed an article, you had to go through an interlibrary loan and wait and wait and wait for someone to photocopy that article and get it to you. Today's students don't operate that way at all. They don't go into the library until they already know what they need. They think of the card catalog the way they would think of, lighting a fire in order to cook your food. It's a completely different world. That is well known to many who are in the business of administering the great libraries, but usually when you see people address this question, you see them come from one or another extreme. You see traditionalists who say, we want nothing to do with the digital revolution. We won't cooperate with Google as it's trying to digitalize all these books. We don't want students to have their primary research done online. We want them in the library. We'll give that up. Then there are people on the other side who say, look, we just need to abandon the libraries. Everything important is going to be digitalized. Everything is going to be online. There's no reason to have these massive facilities, all these collections of books. Finally, a word of common sense has come about, and I wrote about this in my article today entitled The Citadel in the Open Space, Will the Library Survive in the Internet Age? It's at my website at albertmuller.com. Robert Darnton, who is the director of the Harvard University Library, has written an article entitled The Library in the New Age, and it is sheer brilliance. For the first time, I think someone has addressed this, understanding that the library does have a continuing place, but it's not a competition with the digital world. Students, researchers, scholars are going to be spending an enormous amount of time online. It's available to them 24/7. It is the democratization of information. It's available to more people in a more easily accessible form than ever before. And we should actually be very thankful for that, even as we try to come up with understanding how we can best preserve and protect the integrity of that information, even as we're making it accessible. But at the same time, somewhere behind the digital edition, there still has to be a book. There still has to be the citadel, to use Robert Darnton's phrase, his metaphor about where the book is actually found. And even in the digital revolution, not every book will be digitalized. Somewhere, someone's going to need a book that no one considered even worthy of being put in a digital form. Somewhere, there's still going to be a scholar who's going to be camped out in the corner of a building filled with books. And we should be thankful for that. Now, there are those of you out there who are wondering, what in the world does this have to do with me? Well, it has to do with how we all, and especially as Christians, think about the book. I mean, just think about the difference between having a digitalized edition of the Scripture and a Bible. Now, I'm thankful for the digital revolution. I'm thankful for all these searchable texts. I'm thankful for the fact that I've got Bible software on my computer that will enable me to find every time a word is used in every context to change it so that I can understand it in different languages, put it into context, bring up a map that has to do exactly with that text if it's a narrative or an historical account. I am thankful for all of that, but I don't take any of that with me into the pulpit. When I'm preaching to people, I do not say, move your cursor to this point. We say, open the book. And when you read a book to your children, you're still going to want to have that book in the hand. Just remember that. That's why, by the way, I give attention to my website to the issue of books and offer the feature known as the reading list. Today I put up a review about a book I want you to know about. It's entitled The Family Bin Laden. The title of the book itself is The Bin Ladens. It's by Steve Cole, twice winner of the Pulitzer Prize, once for the book that he wrote and another time for his work as a reporter with The Washington Post. Let me tell you why this book is important. It puts the bin Laden family, that's right, the family of Osama bin Laden, in its historical context. And I tell you what is so important about that. It reminds us that there is a story here. And when we think about the challenge of facing the realities of our times, this is a very important story. It tells us a lot about Saudi Arabia. It tells us a lot about the modern Arab challenge. It tells us a lot about what we think we know. For instance, when you get a lot of experts out there talking about the source of terrorism, they will tell you that it's coming from massive resentment from poverty. But the bin Laden family was one of the richest, is still one of the richest families in all of Arabia. The bin Laden family had a private airplane before any other non-royal family in Saudi Arabia. The family had instant access to the princes and kings of Saudi Arabia and made hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars, over time billions of dollars, building in the Middle East. Osama bin Laden was the beneficiary of that family. He is a part of a generation that includes, well, a very large number of children, all of them dealing with massive inheritance. It just reminds us that human evil is never explained by social context. It's explained by Genesis 3. there are people with money and without money, equally sinners before God. You can't reduce these issues to something so simple as economics. That's where Marx would have us to look. It's not where the intelligent Christian will look for the source of the problem. We'll be back to talk about what it means to be human and why we would argue that human beings are distinctive and why human dignity is still important. Coast to coast and with listeners around the world, you're listening to the Albert Mueller Program.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mueller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back, folks. There are certain questions every single worldview must answer. One of those is, what does it mean to be human? And you could say that there are few questions more pressing than that. So immediately, for instance, when you find yourself confronted with a different worldview, it often comes to appearance in discussing what it means to be human. And let's just take our own social context here, our own intellectual context here in the United States of America. Let's look at the confrontation between a biblical worldview held by informed Christians and a secular worldview informed by evolutionary theory. Just to take what it means to be human, evolutionists do believe that there is something distinctive about human beings because they believe that there are different species. There are differentiations between genus and species and type and all the rest. They believe there's something distinctive, but they don't believe there's anything that would be described as dignity. It's really hard to get to that because if human beings are simply a biological accident in the company of other biological accidents, then whatever distinction there is simply a matter of accident. On the other hand, the biblical worldview begins with the understanding that everything that is the purpose of creation, of a holy God who made human beings distinctively in his image. What sets human beings apart is that we are the only being made in the image of God. Now, if you start with those questions, that is, what does it mean to be human? How do we know a human being when we see one? Is there anything special about being human? When you start thinking about that, you realize that those two worldviews are diametrically opposed. That is true regardless of the worldview. If you're going to find a major distinction, you're likely to find it over the question of what it means to be human. The New Scientist magazine, out just coming today by mail, the headline, "Humans are obviously unique, period. But it's surprisingly hard to say why." The article is by Christine Canale. This is what she writes in the beginning. "We humans are not as special as we might like to think. Over the past decade, hard scientific fact has steadily chipped away at our supposedly unique qualities, revealing many of them to be just more sophisticated versions of traits found elsewhere in the animal world. The line dividing us from the rest of nature has steadily shifted. Now, the last stronghold of human uniqueness has fallen." Now, that's a lead. I mean, you certainly want to follow up on that. The last stronghold of human uniqueness has fallen. It's very interesting. Let me just point to you some of the issues that, from the secular scientific perspective, have been raised in order to argue that human beings are different. Six in particular are identified in this article. As a matter of fact, the author of this article went back to previous articles in this same magazine, The New Scientist, in order to find these arguments. Very clever way of making her point. Number one, culture. Back in 2001, this same magazine ran an article that said art, theater, literature, music, religion, architecture, and cuisine, these are the things we associate with culture. Clearly, no other animal has anything approaching this level of cultural sophistication. But, now comes the magazine to say, maybe human beings are just different in degree when it comes to culture, because it argues that killer whales, for example, fall into two distinct groups, residents and transients, going on to say that different animals do actually have what we might call culture. Well, so much for that. Human beings aren't so special after all. Mind reading. Back in 1998, the magazine argued perhaps the surest sign that an individual has insight into the mind of another is the ability to deceive. To outwit someone, you must understand their desires, intentions, and motives, exactly the same ability that underpins the theory of mind. That is, that human beings are distinct because we have the ability to read other minds. Now the magazine says, maybe not. Experiments in the 1990s indicate that great apes and some monkeys are able to deceive. Well, so much for human dignity. The third argument for human specialness, distinction, dignity that is offered from a secular worldview is emotions. From the article in May 2007, emotions allow us to bond with others, regulate our social interactions, and make it possible to behave flexibly in different situations. We are the only animals that need to do these things. But it turns out, we're not the only animal, says the magazine, with emotions. Elephants caring for a crippled herd member seem to show empathy. A funeral ritual performed by magpie suggests grief. Was it spite that led a male baboon named Nick to take revenge on a rival by urinating on her? Well, evidently, the argument is, animals have emotions too, coming out in somewhat different form. The fourth argument that was suggested here in this magazine in 2002 is the use of tools. Human beings are distinctive because we are the only beings able to make, invent, devise, and then utilize tools. But the magazine now argues that some chimps use rocks to crack nuts, others fish for termites with blades of grass, and a gorilla has been seen gauging the depth of water with the equivalent of a dipstick. All right, so human beings have more ability at culture than other animals, better ability to read minds, more demonstrable emotions, and more extensive use of tools, but the magazine argues it's not really a distinction of degree, just of kind. Morality. This is what a lot of people come up with. What makes human beings different than the animal kingdom is that we are moral creatures. However, along comes the magazine to suggest in 2002 that monkeys have been shown to think that stealing food from other monkeys is wrong. It even suggests that some rats have a very primitive morality. Personality is the sixth argument they offer. Human beings are different because we have a sense of personality, a sense of self, a self-consciousness, and distinctions between members of the species such that we speak of each other as demonstrably different by personality and character. But along comes the magazine in 2001 to say, wait just a minute, animals have personality too. They can even recognize personality in each other. There is the discovery that individuals of the same species living under the same conditions vary in their degree of boldness or caution. It's remarkable. So what does all this mean? This means that this scientific journal has come to the conclusion that human beings aren't all that special after all, because when it comes to culture, mind reading, emotions, tool use, morality, and personality, we're just like animals, but better than. We're just more advanced. The last citadel to fall, guess what it is? It's language. The suggestion, remember when I read to you the lead from her article, it says, now the last stronghold of human uniqueness has fallen. That's language. Where, from a secular evolutionary standpoint, there has been the argument that human beings are distinctive because we, unlike other animals, have sophisticated language. Now comes the supposed finding offered in this scientific journal that the animals have language too. Orangutans use gestures remarkably similar to human gestures. Other animals use voice boxes in order to communicate with one or another, including dolphins and whales and other animals. What a hoot, says the magazine. Wild chimps also use loud cries known as pant hoots to communicate at a distance, and careful observation has revealed that these, too, are neither meaningless nor involuntary. So what does it mean to be human? The bottom line of this article and the cover story in The New Scientist is, scientists have no clue. Where will this lead? Well, you can figure that out pretty fast, can't you? It's going to lead to new momentum for animal rights, new momentum for the claim there's nothing really distinctive about human beings. We as Christians have a very different answer. Let's be thinking very carefully about how we would answer this. Our argument for why human beings are distinctive and why human beings have dignity other animals do not possess is not rooted in language or morality. It's not unconnected to those things. It's rooted in the fact that each single human being, every single one, is made in the image of God. My argument is this: you forfeit that argument, you've got no argument for human dignity. Back with more in just a moment. You're listening to the Albert Miller Program.
listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back. We're talking about what it means to be human and why, once you forfeit the Christian worldview, you really don't have much to hold on to as an argument for why human beings should be treated any differently than the animals. And we see this kind of nonsense all around us, certainly in Europe and in Canada and increasingly in the United States as well. I was on the campus of Harvard University about 3 years ago when they were having a conference about legal representation for animals, primates in particular. We are living in an age of nonsense. There's a lot more from this article I want to share with you. But first, I want to take a call. I want to invite you to call as well. Call me at 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. The challenge is, if you do not use the Christian worldview as your mode of argument, if you do not believe that human beings are made in the image of God, then how in the world are you going to argue that there's anything unique about human beings that means human beings should be treated differently than any other animal? Let's go to Bill, listening on WFIA, calling from Hardinsburg, Indiana. Go ahead, Bill.
Yes, Dr. Mohler. My question is, if animals are given rights, who will represent them and how will they be represented?
You know, Bill, I love that kind of question because that's the question of a sane man. And let's just follow out what you're saying there. You're saying that if we give animals rights, and let's give them legal representation, they're going to have a human legal representative. It's not going to be another ape. Now, let me tell you that that's a sane argument, Bill, because you're a sane man, and I want to tell you that there are people that do not appreciate your sanity, because I was reading an article not too long ago in which it was said that we should understand that some human beings can't represent themselves, and babies don't hire other babies to be their attorneys, but someone has to be assigned to be the attorney on their behalf in court. So they consider that a defeater argument, Bill, and I consider you a sane man. You know, let me take your argument and create a parallel to it. I dealt with this on this program, I don't know, a year or two ago. In some European zoo, I guess it was about a year ago, they had an exhibit of human beings that were in the primate cages. They put human beings in as if human beings were animals. And their point was human beings are just another animal. But the reality is the human beings are the only ones that went home after that little experiment. And the human beings were the ones that had to create the signs. The chimpanzees did not put the human beings in there and then put up a sign that said human house. It's nonsense. Really appreciate your call, Bill. And that's exactly the point, isn't it? That human beings are the only ones having this argument. There is not an animal rights argument going on in the animal world. They're not holding symposia, publishing books, and arguing nonsense. To join the conversation, give me a call at 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Every argument has high stakes, but it's hard to imagine an argument with more stacked on it than this. We're talking about what it means to be human. We're talking about why we treat human beings differently, why we punish people who murder a human being differently than someone who hits a dog with a car, why we give medical resources to human beings rather than to animals and feel no guilt about that in the first place, understanding that priority is to human beings, why we understand that human beings have rights that animals do not have. Once you forfeit the Christian worldview, it turns out to be very, very difficult to sustain that argument. Now, back just as we began the program, I shared with you seven arguments that Christine Kennelly, in the current issue of The New Scientist, said just won't hold anymore. And you'll remember those arguments were that human beings were unique because of culture, mind reading, emotions, tool use, morality, personality, and language. But there's a little box, and I love this. When you get to the end of her article, it's the cover story in this week's issue of the magazine. When you get to the final page, there is a little box on the left that's titled, What's Left to Us? You're going to love this. This is entertainment as well as education going on here, folks, because if you're not smiling as you hear this, you're not getting it. These are people trying to come up with an argument without any reference to a creator, without any reference to a biblical or Christian worldview as to why human beings are distinct, and they've already gotten rid of all the arguments that they've been basing their argument on for years. So they got to come up with something new, okay? Here's what they're suggesting. Human beings are different because, one, we are artists. Let me read to you what it says here. It says, although various primates and even elephants have charmed the art world with their abstract paintings, human beings are the only species capable of representational drawing. Okay, now let me ask you, if push comes to shove, and you've got to make an argument for why the child is saved rather than the chimp, are you going to base that argument on the fact that the child can draw a representational piece of art, whereas the chimp can't? You know? Well, give them E for effort on this one, and there's more to come. You're going to love this list of why they say human beings are different, at least for now, until they find out that somewhere, in some place, in some time, there's a porpoise who's just great with a charcoal pencil. Be right back with the Albert Mueller Program.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mueller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 877-8-GOLD-101.
Here is the headline to the article that is the substance of our conversation today. It's by Christine Keneally. It's in the current issue of The New Scientist. She starts out by saying, "We humans are not as special as we might like to think. Over the past decade, hard scientific fact has steadily chipped away and our supposedly unique qualities, revealing many of them to be just more sophisticated versions of traits found elsewhere in the animal world." Folks, there's a big worldview agenda going on here, a political, social, cultural agenda going on here, a legal agenda. When you see, for instance, in the newspaper, as was published earlier this week, that there are those who are pushing for primates to be given legal representation, for animal rights to be considered the same as humans, when you have someone like Peter Singer at Princeton University, who argues that there are some pigs and some cows who possess greater dignity because of greater conscious thinking than some human beings, you realize this is not a hypothetical argument. But when you have a society that has forfeited a biblical worldview that begins the argument about human dignity with the fact that we are made in the image of God, and you try to use an evolutionary worldview that holds that everything that has happened is an accident anyway, and you try to argue for human dignity, you've got to come up with some kind of capacity, some kind of behavior, or some trait or ability that other animals don't have. You have to come up with some kind of argument, like that human beings are the only animals with culture, that use tools, that possess morality, that can read minds, that possess emotions, demonstrate different personality, and use language. But as Christine Keneally argues in this article, it's been demonstrated that animals, some kind of animal, some animal somewhere, possesses some or all of those things, so they can't mean that having this is all that special. That little box at the end of the article I mentioned in the last segment is where it gets really interesting, because here she comes back to say there are still five things that human beings seem to have distinctive from other animals. The first is the ability to be artists. Representational art, that means art you can recognize as something. Representational art is art that is supposed to be a picture of a house or a person or a building or a dog, and you can tell that. The second thing she mentioned, you're going to love this. What makes human beings distinctive? You're trying to come up with an argument for human dignity here. Just remember that. You're trying to come up with an argument that doesn't have any reference to human beings being made in the image of God, so you got to come up with a secular argument. Here is the second try, okay? Cooking. Let me read to you exactly what she writes. Terrestrial animals have an innate fear of fire, but it seems our ancestor, Homo erectus, overcame it to pioneer cooking perhaps as early as 1.9 million years ago. So human beings are different because they say our evolutionary precursor, Homo erectus, almost 2 million years ago, if you buy into this worldview, pioneered cooking by overcoming fear of fire. And, you know, well, let's put it this way. She's at least right about that. In the zoo, there are no kitchens in the animal houses, all right? They're not cooking. You've never come across, you know, some cows in a field who are standing around a fire getting ready to cook dinner. It just doesn't happen. Okay, do you want to base your argument for human dignity on that? Do you want to argue that you save the child out of the burning house rather than the dog on the basis of the fact the child can grow up to cook? I don't know. Seems pretty inadequate to me. The third is religion. Let me just read to you again what she says. She says, belief in a supernatural being is probably not attainable by non-human animals, since they lack sophisticated imagination and the ability to attribute mental states such as desire, belief, and knowledge to other individuals. Now notice here that her understanding of religion is that it's entirely a human experience and a human construct. But she says it appears to be found only among humans. The fourth, she suggests, is humor. You're going to love this. I think her entire argument is accidentally humorous, but here's what she says. Chimps, gorillas, and even rats laugh. But slapstick aside, humor requires language skills beyond the reach of non-human animals. I'm not making this up, folks. I'm reading. This is from The New Scientist. I'm holding it in my hands. One of the world's most respected scientific journals, known for its reporting in science and technology news, is dated May 24 through 30, 2008. And it says that rats laugh. Now, I am not an expert on rats. I can just tell you that up until this point, I thought that only rats designed by Pixar and Disney laughed. But evidently, some scientist somewhere says that rats laugh. But they don't laugh the way we laugh. Humor requires language skills beyond the reach of non-human animals. Again, let's go back to the burning building. In the burning building is a human baby and a dog. Are you going to really make the argument that you save the human infant first because the human infant can laugh? The last thing offered is sport. All social animals play, but sport is a unique kind of play, often entailing special equipment, complex rules, referees, and dedicated spectators. Far from being trivial, sport is underpinned by many of our most advanced cognitive abilities. All right. I'll just have to take them for granted in this. I'm surprised they didn't come up with the claim that somewhere they have found hamsters playing basketball. But they admit there is a distinction between humans and what they call other animals because the other animals may play, but they don't come up with fields and umpires and referees and, for all that matter, little animal bookies. Folks, the big point in all of this and the reason why this is so important for our consideration is that it demonstrates that you really do have an enormous divide between the Christian worldview and any other worldview on the basic question of what it means to be human. And let's realize the fact that when you look at America, just take this nation, take this culture, this society, this system of laws, this constitutional experiment, it is based upon an understanding that human beings are different. I mean, after all, the claim that is made at the very heart of the American experiment is that human beings possess certain rights, inalienable rights, granted, even as some would believe, by nature and nature's God. See, that is gone. That is gone. If you deny that there is a creator, then you really have no basis for making an argument for these rights. That's exactly what the scientists are trying to do. They're trying to come up with some argument because it's convenient to have such an argument because you do want to explain why human beings are different. And so we're now looking at people on the other side who are calling for extreme animal rights. We're not talking about treating animals with respect. We're talking about giving animals rights, granting animals rights like they're human beings. And you know, this really is working both ways because we're not only seeing the arguments for animal rights, we're seeing the forfeiting of human dignity on almost every hand. Whether it's infanticide, human stem cell research, what's going on with euthanasia and the elderly, what's going on with even a new eugenics, germline therapies and genetic enhancements and designer babies. The issue of human dignity is front and center in all these issues, and it ever will be. We better know what we're up against. That's why this kind of article is so helpful, and that's why we just had to pay it attention. Back with concluding thoughts in just a moment. You're listening to the Albert Mueller Program. You know, one of the issues we have to face, one of the questions we have to answer is why human beings are different than anything else in creation. That's an essential part of the Christian gospel and it's an essential part of the Christian story. It's a question addressed by every worldview, but from a Christian perspective, it's really one of the first questions we have to get to because it explains the whole story. In this point, let's get this very clearly. We believe that every single human being is made in the image of God, that to be human means to be created in the image of God, and we believe that the image of God means many things, some of them we don't even know yet, but as revealed in Scripture, one thing that is absolutely central is that we are the only being who is able consciously to know and to glorify the Creator. That's at least central to what it means to be made in the image of God. We have the capacity to know Him, to have a relationship with Him. It is also a moral capacity. And that moral capacity is what is so important in the second thing we know about human beings, and that is that every single human being, having been created in the image of God, is a sinner. That is an essential piece of knowledge. We have to know that. That's what helps to explain. It's essential to explaining human behavior. It's essential to explaining what we see in the mirror. It's essential to understanding our neighbors, our children, our parents, our brothers and sisters, society at large, crime, disobedient children, and everything else that is a symptom of our fallenness. If you deny sin, you have to come up with something that is merely therapeutic, some kind of illness or incapacity or syndrome as the answer to why human beings are as they are. But we also know something else, and that is that every single human being created in the image of God, every single human being who is a sinner, has only one means of escape from the human problem, and that is the redemption that is ours through Jesus Christ our Lord. And that's why the church has the responsibility to get the gospel to every single human being, believing that there is a special responsibility we have, different than our responsibility for stewardship and creation, as important as that is, more important than our relationship of trust and respect with animals, which should exist. And as Christians, we have a whole huge dimensionality to why we understand that, because we understand that we are the stewards of the world that the Lord has given us, this garden that we have been assigned to tend. But we do understand there's a distinction between human beings and all the rest of creation, and in particular human beings and the animal kingdom, because human beings are not only the ones made in the image of God, human beings are not only the only animal to have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God, human beings are the only animal, the only creature for whom Christ died. Everything else flows from that, folks. Every once in a while, an article in something like The New Scientist helps to make that point abundantly clear. Back tomorrow for Intelligent Christian Conversation. I'm Albert Mohler.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmohler.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmohler.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.